The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller, coming up on today's programme. Russia partially protests as Russia partially mobilizes. Also ahead, a roundup of Latin American news and business headlines, a reflection on the InnoTrans railway trade fair in Berlin, and look, I know, but he's joining us from Brazil. He's really tremendously excited about it. Just grin and bear it. It's only like 6 minutes out of your day. I've read this out loud again, haven't I?
Hi, Andrew. So for today's Global Countdown, it's a little bit of a special one. I'll be counting down the top five best political jingles in Brazil.
That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. The partial mobilization ordered by Russian President Vladimir Putin is underway. Up to 300,000 reservists, debatably enthusiastic, dubiously qualified, possibly haphazardly trained and equipped, are being shipped off to spend winter on the receiving end of a motivated and well-armed military defending its own territory. The call-up has prompted a mobilization of a different sort, of relatively small numbers of indisputably brave people, who have run the considerable risks associated with expressing dissent openly in Russia. I'm joined with more on this by Benno Zog, Monocle security correspondent, and by Natalia Vasilyeva, Moscow correspondent for The Telegraph, who joins us from Istanbul. Benno, first of all, let's have a look at this mobilization. Now that it is underway, do we get any sense of the scale of it and what it indicates about how well or badly this is going for Russia?
This is actually quite hard to estimate because Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu has indicated that the goal is to mobilize 300,000 troops, which sounds like an exaggerated number. So we're not quite clear on what the number actually is. What he means and what we already see is that indeed young men across the country are called to arms, if you will, or forced to arms, whatever you call it, and that this mobilization has in a way already started. But as he indicated earlier, of course, these are probably poorly motivated troops. Many of them have received only basic training and maybe possibly 10 years ago or so. So to actually train them, to equip them, to feed them, and to integrate them, and this last step is key, to integrate them in any kind of actual fighting force, will take a very long time. So the actual effects cannot be felt anytime soon. It can only be possibly short-term relief for certain of the fighting troops on Russia's side in Ukraine. But it's been a very big statement. It's turned the special military operation into a war in the Russian perception. I think that's mostly key, this kind of signal that was sent, even if in the real world, in the battlefield, it doesn't show that quickly.
Natalia, we will come to the open protests shortly, but what's your sense of what might occur in the shape of more furtive or cloistered resistance to this mobilization, i.e. people leaving the country, trying to contrive reasons why they can't go, that kind of thing?
Sure. We're already seeing that. I'm just hearing on a personal level, Russian men are trying to find contacts at the draft offices, trying to figure out a way to dodge it. People are literally running for their lives. This morning, we saw quite extraordinary scenes at various border crossings out of Russia, including at the destinations which were would be quite unpopular in recent years. There were long lines seen at the border with Mongolia, at the border with Kazakhstan, at the border with Georgia. All flights were sold out. All flights to popular visa-free destinations for Russia were sold out in the middle of hours yesterday. And at the same time, we saw a couple of attacks overnight. Unclaimed attacks against a city hall in a small town in the Volga region and a conscription office elsewhere. So even without directly protesting, there's obviously a feeling that this is an extremely unpopular move, and Russians are going to do whatever they can to resist it.
Benno, it is nevertheless a fairly dramatic escalation by Vladimir Putin, and we have seen an escalation of sorts in response from the European Union, which is drawing up a raft of fresh sanctions. What is there left to sanction that hasn't been sanctioned already?
That's a tricky question, and that's not even asking the question, of course, whether sanctions can affect either the performance of the Russians on the battlefield or affect Russian political decision-making in any way. This will be, I stopped counting at some point, probably the eighth or so or more round of sanctions that the EU will enact. And it's, I would argue, it's probably even more linked to the other announcement that we've seen this week from Moscow, which is to hold pseudo or fake referendums in four Ukrainian regions about, well, do they want to join the Russian Federation? And these are regions that are obviously undisputedly Ukrainian, that Russia doesn't even militarily fully occupy at the moment. So this kind of actual annexation, which Moscow long has denied, will certainly trigger European responses. And there's a few potential sanctions that are being discussed. One is in the energy realm, where clearly, in a way, Western sanctions don't really work because Russian income from hydrocarbons is still super high. So that's this idea to now follow through with a price cap, as in only up to a certain price will there be payments for energy, and it will not fully follow market functions. The other obvious sanction is the usual, which is travel bans and asset freezes on further individuals that are in any way responsible on the Russian side for these latest steps. I think those are the obvious ones. But maybe there's some creative ones coming in as well. There was rumor about potential sanctions on luxury good trade with Russia, obviously targeting the ones that are still in Russia and wealthy enough to afford that.
Natalia, let's look then at these protests. It's obviously not easy to get a clear sense of what is actually happening in Russia because independent reporting from inside Russia is next to impossible. But from what you have been able to glean, what should we be thinking about the scale of these things? Are they really that big a deal?
Sure. I think it depends on what do you mean by is it a bigger deal? It's where no one was expecting protests of hundreds of thousands of people like we saw in Russia 5 years ago or in 2011, 2012. I think it's important to remember that Russia adopted several draconian laws at the onset of the war, including a law on war propaganda, which essentially makes any anti-war statement a crime. Russia is essentially a totalitarian military dictatorship right now. If you think in those terms, it's incredibly hard to protest in a country like that. So the numbers that we saw yesterday, we saw protests in about, I've seen the figure, 36 Russian cities where arrests were reported, about 1,300 people have been arrested. This is still quite massive for the risks that those people are taking for the cost of those protests, because literally everyone who was out on the streets yesterday risks jail time for that. So it is an expression of how unpopular the war is and the mobilization is, and how for many who took to the streets yesterday, it's a cry for help. And for them, the stakes couldn't be higher. It's essentially, it's a life or death situation right now.
And Natalia, just finally, Is it possible to estimate how big protests would need to get before the Russian regime was properly rattled by them?
Again, it depends on what you mean. If the regime is rattled or not, we saw massive protests in Russia in 2011 when Putin decided to run for another term to return into power after two terms in office. Kremlin essentially did not back down to those demands of free elections at this time. We're definitely not in a situation of a revolution right now, because large scale protests in a well functioning totalitarian regime, which is Russia right now, are pretty much impossible.
Natalia Vasilyeva and Benno Zog, thank you both for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Paige Reynolds with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Protesters in Tehran and other Iranian cities torched police stations and vehicles as unrest triggered by the death of a woman detained by the morality police intensified. 22-year-old Mahsa Amini died last week after being arrested for wearing unsuitable attire. She fell into a coma while in detention. The incident has sparked the worst protests in Iran since 2019. China has sentenced former Justice Minister Fu Zhenghua to death for taking bribes and bending the law for selfish ends. In July, Fu admitted to accepting over 117 million yen or $16.5 million in bribes. And poetry fans across Asia can rejoice. Literary journal Mekong Review has secured new owners to save it from an unhappy ending. The title had seemed doomed to fold after its founder relocated from Australia to the UK. To read more about it, sign up to our daily newsletter, The Monocle Minute. Head to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Paige. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Time now to get the latest business headlines with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, in the last few minutes, an interest rate rise from the Bank of England.
Andrew, yes, a second consecutive half-point hike in UK interest rates from the Bank of England just within the last 10 minutes or so, increasing rates to 2.25%. The decision was actually split 5-4. The other members wanted to increase by even more, by 0.75%. The UK, of course, facing the same problem as many countries around the world. Inflation at just about 10%, something central banks have really been on the back foot trying to tackle. We heard from the world's most important central bank yesterday, the Federal Reserve. They've raised US interest rates by 0.75%. We used to call 0.5% a bumper hike. Now we call 75 basis points. 0.75% is now seen as a big hike. It's the third consecutive rise of 0.75% by the Federal Reserve. And they gave their clearest signal yet that they're willing to tolerate a recession in the US as the necessary trade-off for regaining control of inflation. We also heard from Sweden's central bank earlier in the week. They've increased rates by a full percentage point. You'll see a theme emerging here. And Switzerland becoming the final central bank in Europe to exit negative interest rates after a period of 8 years. Switzerland moving their rates into positive territory. There is one global holdout in this story, and that is Japan. Its central bank sticking with its ultra low rate policy, but that is having a very heavy effect on the Japanese currency, which has been under attack. The dollar has been rising around the world, and the yen has now fallen by 20% against the dollar this year. Whether they can continue fighting that strong dollar remains an open question. But the Japanese central bank intervening to prop up the yen for the first time since the 1990s. The central bank has intervened quite a few times over the years to fight a strong yen. But this is the first time in 20 years that the Japanese central bank has tried to prop up a weak yen. So the Japanese central bank really trying to make sure that currency doesn't keep falling against the dollar. But we've heard before, it's very difficult for central banks to fight the markets.
Just a quick follow-up on that, Ewan. You mentioned the 5-4 split among the Bank of England's grandees. I suspect that the short answer to this question is yes, but does that tell us that this shouldn't be the last bump in interest rates that we expect?
No, it certainly won't be. We're expecting more over the course of this year and more next year as well. The UK really is in a bit of a tricky position because the the job market is very tight like the US, but it is also facing that same energy crunch as the rest of Europe. Energy prices have soared, of course, many times, particularly for businesses over the last few months, and that is really fueling inflation. So the central bank is really facing a very tricky balancing act, trying to fight inflation, but also not to crush the economy, which is something the Federal Reserve is really at pains to do as well.
Well, on the subject of inflation, just finally, one commodity which has not been increasing in price in recent months is copper. Why is that?
Yeah, it's used in everything from computer chips and toasters to power systems and air conditioners. But the price of copper has dropped by nearly a third since March. Now, the commodity is seen as a key bet on the future strength of the global economy. And investors at the moment, well, they are pretty pessimistic. But while they might be hoping for a slowing of inflation in a lot of things, the drop in copper's price is very much a mixed blessing. It's the subject of today's Bloomberg Big Take. It's a long read on the copper price. Quite an interesting story, actually. Some of the biggest miners and metals traders are warning that in just a couple of years' time, there is going to be a massive shortfall in the world's most critical metal. It's used in so many things. It's, of course, key for the transmission of electricity. There's about 30 kilograms in the average car, rather more in an electric car, about 180 kilograms in a new home. So copper used in all sorts of things, but inventories are at very low levels. And the latest price volatility means that new mine output, which is already projected to start petering out in 2024, could become even tighter in the near future. There's a warning today from the world's biggest publicly traded copper supplier that prices are just insufficient to support new investments. A very large copper project in Peru has been pulled just within the last week or so. So the danger is that the low copper price is not going to support investment, and that means that in a couple of years' time there is going to be a crunch when it comes to the supply of this key metal. Really interesting story on the copper front.
Ewan Potts at Bloomberg, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24, and if you've been listening to Monocle 24 all week, you will know that we had a good few team members decamping to Berlin for the 2022 edition of InnoTrans, the world's largest trade fair focused on the rail transport industry. And one monocleur who has returned from the festivities is business editor David Hodari, who joins me in the studio. David, first of all, this InnoTrans, and I think this is the case with a lot of regular annual events, was the first proper full-blown, full-dress in-person edition they have been able to hold for some time, for the obvious reasons. What was the atmosphere like? Was there even more excitement about trains than usual?
Well, so I've been to a few trade fairs this year, it's all in a business editor's work, and they've often been a bit gloomy given the economic backdrop, the sort of post-pandemic mood music, the war in Ukraine. But InnoTrans was very, very upbeat. The transit sector appears ready to breeze past all of that uncertainty, and everyone we spoke with seemed really optimistic that the industry is back in the swing of things post-pandemic, and I think the European Commissioner for Transport summed up the mood when she described the dawn of a second golden age of rail.
Well, this is a thing that the rail industry, I know, is banking rather heavily on, and we see this all over Europe, sort of more long-haul-ish routes being introduced, more sleeper cars being invested in. This idea that people are starting to worry sufficiently about the environmental effects of air travel that people are thinking, well, maybe the train is a better option. And I guess, as anybody who has attempted to negotiate a European airport in the last few months will be aware, train stations are also a lot less hassle.
Yeah, you'd be right about that. I mean, the main takeaway from my point of view is that the rail industry is going as green as possible, as quickly as possible. And we often associate trains with diesel or even in the popular imagination, coal. But unlike the aviation space, it's actually an industry that has a concrete plan to slash its emissions. Electrification is obviously continuing, but the probably the most commonly referenced future fuel that I heard about this week was hydrogen. It needs large, heavy tanks that have hindered its progress in the aviation sector and in the automotive sector as well. And the same issue goes for batteries, which can be quite bulky, but tanks and batteries that are heavy and broad can actually sit on a train's roof and work quite well.
What were people saying about how the actual passenger experience might evolve?
So I spoke, I sat down with the CEO of Siemens Mobility Software Company, and while that may sound like a slightly dry exercise, it wasn't, because one of the main parts of the effort to slash emissions in the rail industry is a drive for efficiency, and you do that by changing the software being used on trains. Unfortunately, for those of us, including me, who like an empty train, we're going to be seeing fewer and fewer of those as train companies deploy this software to sort of measure the weight of a train car during certain hours of the day, deploy fewer trains at off-peak hours, more trains during on-peak hours, and unfortunately that will also mean fewer cheap train tickets and perhaps a few more expensive ones as well.
So any surprises, basically? Was there anything that you found yourself learning that you didn't really expect to learn about trains in 2022?
Well, one surprise was probably the opening ceremony, which was set to Carmina Burana and involved dancing train conductors. But about the industry in general... in terms of the future of the industry, I was particularly impressed with one train I saw get launched on Wednesday morning, which was a Trenitalia Hitachi sort of tie-up. It's called the Blues Train, which is a three-way hybrid, and it can run on batteries. It can run on electric traction, you know, the overhead wires that you see, and also diesel where necessary. And I think we could be seeing more of that kind of thing going forward. We'll see, you know, trains that can that fit the current demands and opportunities of the rail system as we have it in 2022, and ones that are prepared for a more electric, more low emissions future.
Monocle's business editor David Hadari, thank you for joining us. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. It's time now for a wrap-up of news from Latin America, and here to help with exactly that is Monocle's Latin America Affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott. Lucinda, let's start with, well, not so much Latin America as the people leaving it for the United States, which they are doing in increasing numbers.
For the first time, yes, Andrew, migrants from elsewhere surpassed those who travel across the southern US border who are Mexican. Tens of thousands are no longer originating from the traditional migration countries of Mexico and parts of Central America. And those fleeing Venezuela and Cuba are adding to the flow of people. There's also an uptick in the numbers from Ecuador, from Haiti, and from even further away like Brazil. And the special envoy of President Biden for the Northern Triangle countries, that's Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, has said that an alarming increase in authoritarianism is driving these numbers, but also a failure by governments further south to improve the lives of its people. And just to give listeners an idea of the scale, around 2.3 million migrants were apprehended in the 12 months to the end of July, which is an increase of 63% on the same period a year earlier. And those, of course, are only represent those who were detained. Others have obviously made it into the US. And it really says a lot about the state of the Americas and the plight of Latin Americans since the pandemic.
We did hear from quite a few Latin American leaders at the United Nations General Assembly in New York City this week. Did any of them address this X-flow from their end?
Yeah, I mean, Gabriel Boric of Chile did talk openly about the issues in Venezuela in particular that are causing huge economic stress to the north of his country and the need to address the humanitarian problems. Boric also really kind of honed in on the environment, his support for Ukraine. He also sort of introduced Chile to the audience in sort of echoes of Salvador Allende, the first leftist leader, you know, what Chile exports, where it stands politically. Brazil's Bolsonaro, who opened the assembly and basically used the platform to campaign ahead of the election in a few weeks' time, he touched on Venezuelans migrating to Brazil. He said that 350,000 of them have been given some form of state support by the Brazilian authorities. And he did talk about the number of Ukrainians, actually, and Haitians. But it wasn't really a central topic in any of the speeches that were given by Latin American officials, really.
Well, just finally on this, one of the more keenly anticipated addresses from a Latin American leader was that of recently installed Colombian President Gustavo Petro. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so Petro of Colombia gave quite an explosive criticism of capitalism, of how this region suffers from the demands for oil and for drugs. He said the drug war had failed. I mean, those who support him as the first sort of left-wing leader, as you say, of Colombia, felt he really kind of stuck it to the West. There were reminders, really, of Hugo Chavez of Venezuela when he made that famous UN Assembly speech saying, "Hay olor a azufre," it smells of sulfur, after George Bush had left the podium. But, you know, obviously for half of Colombians who didn't vote for Petro, it's been a big shift. I mean, they were pretty appalled, really, and said he didn't really appear statesmanlike or touch on any of the topics that maybe are more pressing on a global stage, really.
Lucinda Elliott, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing.
Want to ease into your Saturdays and Sundays in top form? Then tune into Monocle Weekends, where we offer up smart discussion.
If they take the view that newspapers lie to them, that journalists make things up, then they will prefer to believe other people.
The latest from the front pages.
The Neue Zürcher Zeitung am Sonntag is reporting that Switzerland's already set aside 200 million francs.
Magazine tips, plenty of authors.
That gives me the theatre where my characters will act.
And pointers for better evenings on your terrace.
Me, I open more than one bottle because it's easier than just to focus on one bottle.
Join me, Georgina Godwin.
Me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Me, Emma Nelson, from London.
And from Zurich, me, Tyler Brulé. Weekends live right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. It is last thing on Thursday, which means it is time for Fernando Augusto Pacheco's Global Countdown. And though Fernando is a long way away from us today, it turns out it's not nearly far enough to stop him. Fernando, whereabouts are you?
Well, I am in São Paulo, and I have actually a blanket over me, Andrew, because it's been the coldest September in the last 30 years in São Paulo. So it wasn't the best September to come here, I have to say.
Well, we do have a Brazilian theme for this week's top five, but it's not what's top five in Brazil this week, is it?
No, it's basically the top five political jingles in Brazil. And the reason why, because I think political jingles are so important here. It's you need a good song to be elected. Basically, that's all I'm saying. And it can be all sorts of genres. It's incredible. I mean, I've been living in the UK for the last decade or more, and I never sing like really a song, "Hey, vote for Liz Truss," you know, in a funk rhythm. But here in Brazil, it's really important. So we're going actually in a chronological order today, Andrew,
okay,
if I may.
This is in order of date, release date, not necessarily quality.
Exactly.
Okay, so what do we have at number five?
Number five is a really interesting one because it's Jânio Quadros. It's from 1960. He was basically in power for only 7 months. He had to resign. There was been some, you know, political issues there. But his song, I mean, it's still, people know still today the song. This is the jingle called Varre, Varre, Vassourinha, which is Sweep, Sweep, Little Broom, which is kind of an anti-corruption song. Let's have a little listen to that.
Varre, 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 vassourinha. Varre, varre a bandalheira. O povo já está cansado de sofrer dessa maneira. Jânio Quadros, a esperança desse povo abandonado.
I mean, regular listeners will be aware, Fernando, that I don't mind a bit of accordion. There's a time and a place, but there's something quite melancholy about hearing that now, because obviously here's dude running 62 years ago on a platform of getting corruption out of Brazilian politics, and that still seems to be something of a work in progress.
Absolutely. And let's be honest, Andrew, it is Brazil. And actually, Jânio Quadros, at the late stage of his careers, he was also accused of corruption. So actually, be very careful if somebody's singing about anti-corruption. They might be corrupt themselves.
It's a reasonable bet. At number four.
Number four, that's a classic. He's basically a minor candidate. He tried to be a president six times, including this year. He's been going on since 1985, I believe. He tried to be mayor of São Paulo. He's never been elected to a really kind of important role in politics, but it is damn catchy. I was singing to that today because he still uses the song, even though the song is from 1985. It's by Amael, and as he says in the song, he's a Christian Democrat, but you'll see why the song is so catchy. Let's have a listen at number four.
Hey, 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 Amael, um democrata cristão, da presidente é 27, o nome é Amael, pela família e pela nação. Ei, 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 Brasil, o democrata cristão, pela igualdade e a felicidade.
Fernando, most of our listeners, when they think of Christian Democrats, will think in terms of Germany's Christian Democratic Union. Can we glean from that that Brazil's Christian Democrats, whatever other faults they may have, are basically just a bit more fun than their German counterparts?
They are more fun. And I think Amael, I'm sorry, Amael, but I think a bit less serious as well. I think Amael, he's a bit of a narcissist, I would say. But he does have his fans. I mean, he's trying for the sixth time. Who knows? It might not be Bolsonaro or Lula. We might have Amael in power. And basically for this year, he needs to catch up with the times. So there's a funk version of that song as well, which is not as catchy as that one. But, you know, it's for the TikTok generation, I guess. But the lyrics didn't change.
Well, that's good to hear. At number three.
Number three, something, this song I have to say is quite beautiful. It's from Lula back in 1989 when he tried to be a president for the first time. He was almost elected, actually. And the difference between the other two we've played is that the song was performed by very famous Brazilian singers like Chico Buarque, because Lula has always been connected to the artistic class in Brazil. Perhaps the economic elite never voted for him, but the cultural elite certainly. And he even revisited the song for this year's campaign because it is a classic. This is the song called Lula Lá and number three.
Fernando, that has a somewhat melancholy quality to it, I would say.
It is melancholic, it is beautiful emotion, and Lula Lá means Lula there. And it's the sense that, you know, he's a worker, he grew up in a very poor family. The song is basically saying that someone like him could become president of Brazil. So there's this kind of, this very emotional context to it as well. And as I said, so popular that's been revisited for this year's campaign as well.
Okay, so number two, the tension mounts.
Absolutely. And this is Dilma from the same party as Lula. And it's interesting because nowadays, especially more recently, including this Dilma one, they're trying to use very regional sounds, you know, perhaps to cater to a specific region of Brazil. And this one by Dilma, which is called Coração Valente, Braveheart, is singing the forró genre, which is very popular in the Northeast. It's very fun, lighthearted. It's saying how Dilma is actually a brave woman. Looking at her past, I mean, you can kind of agree with that. Let's have a listen to that.
Você nunca vacilou em lutar em favor da gente. Por isso eu tô juntinho do seu lado. Tô com você e Lula pra seguir em frente. Mulher de mãos limpas, tô com você. Mulher de mãos livres, tô com você.
Fernando, on the basis that that sounds tolerably like one of Marty Robbins' weird Mexicana pastiches, I will allow that one. But it brings us to number one. And I know this is chronological, not, you know, qualitative, but I'm trying to build it up. So the number one Brazilian political jingle is...
It's special. It is basically a mashup of the songs from the four main candidates. We're going to have here very brief excerpts, and then I'll give a very quick explanation. They're from Simone Tebet, Ciro Gomes, Bolsonaro, and Lula.
This is the sound of this year's election.
Yes, very modern, very current.
Hit it.
Agora tenha certeza, tá na hora de olhar pro Ciro. Agora tenha certeza, tá na hora de olhar pro Ciro.
Tá Brasil acima de tudo e Deus acima de todos. É o capitão do povo que vai vencer de novo. Ele é de Deus, você pode confiar. Defende a família e não vai te enganar. É o capitão do povo.
Faz o L, faz um coração grandão, desenrola,
o Brasil tem jeito.
E faz o L, faz um coração grandão, desenrola, o Brasil tem jeito. E faz o L, faz um coração grandão, desenrola.
Fernando, I have no Portuguese at all, as you know, so I'm taking a wild guess. Was Bolsonaro's The Bloody Awful Power Ballad at number three there?
Yes, absolutely. Hey. And I don't know if you could hear it. There's the sound of a kind of a military plane at the background. Of course, it's Bolsonaro, and it's very much a bit of country music as well, because the country community, Andrew, I'm sorry to say, but they're all behind Bolsonaro in this year's campaign. And Ciro Gomes went for samba, which I think was quite a clever decision, I have to say, as well.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco in Sao Paulo with this week's Global Countdown. Thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was Emily Sands, and our studio manager was Callum McLean. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time, midday London. I'm Andrew Muller. I'll be back with The Daily at 1800 London. Thank you for listening.